Welcome to the Eastman Dental Podcast, where we hope to inspire, motivate, and provide education from our guests' experience.
Well, Josh, that was an interview with a really busy dentist, wasn't it?
I know. John Lewis has a great story, and the fact that he's utilising the team so effectively in his practice is something we don't see very often, and it was great to hear him talk about that.
And I think the thing that I really liked was that he was doing different things outside of dentistry to bring back to the practice to help everybody who he works with.
And it was inspirational to hear him talk with such passion about the founding of the dental charity Confidental. And I think our listeners will really gain from that part as well.
I think there's many things out of this episode that they're going to get out of it.
Yeah, so I can't wait for them to hear it. So sit back, listen. Here's this week's episode.
With your hosts, Josh Hudson and Julia Bruin.
So John, welcome to the Eastman Dental Podcast. There's lots of different things that we can talk to you about and that we're going to talk to you about. But first and foremost, myself and Julia would like to know, what got you into dentistry in the first place? Was it a planned thing? Did you fall into it? What's your kind of origin story in dentistry, so to speak?
Well, thank you. And thank you for letting me come on the podcast. Dentistry was just totally by chance. My family were a mining background. My father was in the army. So I'm the first in my family to have the opportunity to go to university. At that point, my parents were abroad and I was at school in the UK. And as you do, you go to the careers advisor. And I went to him and I said, I'd like to do medicine. And I still remember his exact words. He said, it's too difficult. How about dentistry? And that was about the extent of my research. So I went to dentistry. And I've got no regrets. It's been a great career.
I had the same with veterinary. I said I wanted to be a vet and they said that's too hard, and then ended up doing dentistry as well. So similar story.
These sound like a lesson to learn from everybody about motivation from careers teachers rather than a careers dental podcast.
I think that the learning point really is that I suppose at the age 15 you don't think you go with, or in those days you went with what you were advised to do. I think kids nowadays, I probably think a bit more around it, because I know, as I said, my research was totally and utterly non-existent.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the internet's got a lot to answer for with lots of things, but I think certainly careers, I think it really does help to be able to do some proper research. I mean, I'm sure all of us probably had lovely little leaflets that we were given at those sorts of times or that sort of thing. So you decided to open your own practice. So what was the driver to set up your own practice? And then obviously it's developed over the last 30 years.
So life always brings up opportunities. And I'm a great believer that you should take a chance and grab them when you can. They don't always work out, but usually they do. I think you may have guessed from chatting earlier, I love competitive sports. I used to sail, then I went on to distance running. And now as my knees are failing, I've taken up rowing. So 2 years post-qualification, I just split up with my girlfriend and I went sailing at Bala in North Wales at the Easter Regatta. And I thought, I like this place. So by summer, I resigned my job. I got a job as an associate in a nearby town and I built a squat in Bala. Had a happy 5 years there. And I met my wife at the time and she didn't really like Wales. So we decided to go to Cumbria because it was halfway between Newcastle and Wales, which is where she was. And I'd never been to Cumbria before, but we went. And I was a happy associate until 2006. We had no pressures, nice income, nice life. 2006, the previous owner did a private conversion, which went spectacularly wrong. We were financially in difficulties within a year. And I quite liked private dentistry at that point. So I bought the practice one night and it took me 18 months to turn it around financially, which enabled me to have the ability to get a large loan from the bank. And I built this practice as a new build in 2011. My vision was that Cumbria is a rural county. We travel long distances to go anywhere. And my vision was to have a practice that was family based, but kind of offered all the specialities in one building. So 12 years later, we've gone from 3 part-time dentists and I've now got 11 associates, 5 are general and 6 are either specialists or special interests. So it's taken 11 years, but we've just about got there in the end.
Wow. So Was practice ownership on the cards? Was it that your hand was kind of forced in that situation? Was it something that you thought about for a long time, something that kind of just happened? Or how did that actual transition come about?
It was just basically, I knew that previous owner was in difficulties, both emotionally and financially. And it was, I went around to see him one night and I just said, let's have a chat and let's make an offer. And it just went from there. But it had never really crossed my mind again. But it just, as I said, opportunities arise. So sometimes you just have to take them.
So you've just described, I mean, this is a huge practice. You're employing 33 people within the building. What sort of advice would you give somebody who's really in that very early stages of their career and perhaps thinking about practice ownership?
So there's a trend now for people to run multiple practices. I don't know how anybody can. It's not in my mindset. I think I can only do one properly. But everyone for their own. And I think to start off is about having a vision. I knew what I wanted. I knew where I wanted to be. And it's about communicating to people and employing people who share your vision and setting the standards yourself. So you set the standard yourself that you expect everyone else to follow. But it's about also being innovative. Do things differently. Don't follow the crowd. Because if you follow the crowd, you're playing catch-up. Someone's been there already. And as I said previously, it won't always work, but you can learn from your failures. I've just been looking back at the marketing we did when we first moved here. And we did some quite interesting stuff. We, you know, the World Cup was on at the time, and we did World Cup Whitening Wednesdays. We did Try Before You Buy. We did a lot of things, but community, it's a market town. Community was always important. So we had a Gilmout football strip for the under-13s. We had a hockey strip. We sponsored the Christmas lights in town. All the events we could get involved with, we did. And that kind of built a community spirit up. But it's also about getting your practice right. People worry about money and income and budgets, but I think if you get the practice right, patients follow, and then the money comes afterwards.
So I think it's interesting you mentioned community there, and I think that's really important and something that's probably overlooked a little bit kind of these days. But apart from that, what other elements do you think it is that's led your practice to be successful and to be able to grow over this last 30 years? Are there any other key elements that you can tease out that you think, you said there's failures and successes, but what are the key things that you think are the successful parts of that growth?
I think it's a trite word, but it's customer service. Patients or customers or clients or whatever is number one, first, second, and third. They come first. Your team comes second. And it's about also reevaluating everything you do. We've been here for 11 years now. And the last couple of months I have spent taking the practice to bits and rebuilding it again, because you can't stand still. If you stand still, then you go backwards. So we've just looked at everything under the sun. We've done a complete clear out of everything, of all the junk that's accumulated. We're looking at every letter, every communication, everything we do, we're reevaluating and just going to start again. And that hopefully should be finished within a couple of months.
That's really interesting. I'm sitting here listening to this thinking, oh yes, I think I might have to do some practice housework, as they say. I'm being suitably inspired by that. And clearly your team within the practice, you are utilising the whole skill set. I mean, this is not a dental practice that has just got dentists. I'm talking about the fact that you've got the whole range of service provision being done by multiple registrants there. Can you perhaps tell us what your thoughts are about using those different types of people?
So in the practice, everybody has a subsidiary role. Every nurse, every clinician has something else they are personally responsible for, which gives them that sort of, they're the go-to person. But we've always been interested in expanding other roles. I had my first therapist in 2009, and she'd applied for over 90 jobs at that point, and I was the only one who gave her an interview.
Wow.
We've now got three therapists and a hygienist. Some of the therapists prefer hygiene only. And we've always used the full skill mix. but I think things are changing just slightly at the moment. It's a personal feeling. We had the NHS reforms where we were going to have therapist exams. It hasn't been thought through properly. It hasn't happened. And I feel we are in a slight financial situation. You've only got to look at some of the Facebook forums to see that some practices are having more difficulties. And in those situations, it's a natural inclination for clinicians, dentists in particular, to keep the work for themselves. Mm. So my personal feeling is that things are slipping back, and where therapists were beginning to start to use their scope of practice more, I think it's dropping back a bit. And it's evidenced by one of the local dental schools that did the therapy until this year and has now gone back to hygiene only. I don't know. I'd be interested in your thoughts on that one, but it's just a personal feeling.
I think it's just so different depending on where you are in the country, isn't it? You know, of course, there are dental deserts out there, and we've been hearing lots about those areas. But I'm a bit more positive about it than you are, John, actually. I truly believe that I think this is the most exciting time to be part of that. And I think, you know, nothing happens quickly. So, you know, be a bit patient. And I think it will work out in the end.
See, I would go for a complete root and branch change. And I've looked at your Eastman website. And I see you've got the first part of it. I would have every dental student studying therapy to start off with. And at the end of 3 years, then decide whether you want to go on or not, and have the ability for therapists to go back at a later date and retrain for the last bit if they wish.
And people are starting to explore that as an option now. And guests on this podcast, in fact,
I was just going to say, we've got an exciting guest coming in. So listen out for future episodes, really.
I will.
Again,
personal opinion is that I don't know. Are we getting the wrong graduates? Are we getting the wrong candidates? We're getting people who've got 5A stars at university, who've got violin at grade 8, who've got DV gold and whatever, and have worked towards getting the perfect CV. But can they talk to people? Can they communicate? Because dentistry is a communication profession. The skills, I feel, yeah, you need the basic hand skills, but you can teach those to anybody. But it's the communication bit that makes you as a dentist or a therapist.
Yeah, but I think on that note, though, in fairness to us all as a profession, I think those things are not instant. They are not things that you are taught straight away. They are things that develop. And I think if you look back to your younger dental self, and I certainly, you know, as one of your peers, Josh obviously slightly younger than me, but you know, I think that I'm probably a better communicator now than I was when I first qualified. So I think these skills are things that are honed over a number of years and are not instant things, and they are learnt by lots of different ways. So I think we can. I think we've just got to not do an instant thing and think, oh right, it's got to be all right there immediately the minute people qualify. I think it's a very sad day when you actually stop learning generally in our profession.
I think I agree with you totally. Yes, I'm still learning every day on something.
Yeah,
for sure. And I think a lot of what we're talking about in terms of therapists really can start with utilizing therapists effectively. I know you're saying that that's something that you do in your practice, and I think that's something that individual practices can help with. It doesn't have to be a big systematic change. If people are just utilizing therapists better, then that's kind of grassroots changes. So I'm interested to know how have you found that you've been able to utilize therapists? How have you ended up making that successful when at the moment that's not really the norm? There's not that many people that are utilizing therapists effectively.
So we have a small NHS contract, and that has always been totally therapist driven. It's the only way I can make it financially viable. All NHS treatments are completed by therapists within their scope of practice. Mm-hmm. The dentists, up until recently, been doing the examinations. That's changing, but every, apart from the orthodontic extractions of adult teeth or any lab work, everything has been done by therapists.
And how's that?
And it's financially viable because it we are a predominantly private practice, so it frees up the dentist to concentrate more on what they want to do, on their private income, on their private term growth. And actually, to be totally honest, there is no limit on what they can use the therapist for. So there's no chargeback. There's no cost to them. So if a child wants a facial sealant, it can have it. If they want oral hygiene instruction, they can have it. So I feel the quality of the dentistry has improved because the therapist has as much time as they want. So if they need time with a nervous child to do tell, show, do or whatever, they can have it because it's a lesser hourly rate. It's a financial fact of life. But there is no limit on what the time the therapist can spend with any child that they need to.
So it's fascinating hearing about your utilisation of dental therapists within your practice. But of course, we're talking about the whole team here. We could be talking about treatment coordinators. We could be talking about your dental nurses doing radiography, for example, or impression taking. Do you do anything like that in your practice?
Yeah, we have two nurses who are radiography trained. They take the OPGs. We've got a CT, but they're not trained for that as yet. But that's the next development stage. We have nurses that do pre-consults, and we have an intraoral scanner that they'll do pre-consults and photography on. And that kind of filters out for the orthodontics patients who aren't sure, so they can do a scan and some photos and send them across to the orthodontist to have a look at. We have sedation trained nurses. We have three, I think, at the moment, because it's coming up to a fourth. So, yes, they have the ability. And TCOs, we've got two TCOs as well. And they've all been nurses. And they've also, most of my nurses have joined me from school. I tend to not employ someone who's worked elsewhere. They come from school or from other environments outside of dentistry, and then we train them in-house.
And you obviously have a reason for doing that.
Yeah.
I mean, I can guess, and I'm sure our listeners can guess. But I mean, that's just in a day and age where actually registered dental nurses are hard to come by, do you find the training on sort of site, as it were, the best way?
We don't have a difficulty in recruiting. We are lucky with that, but I think it's because we're willing to train. And I consider sometimes myself as a sort of pathway. I've got previous nurses. One's an accountant, one's a social worker, one's a paramedic, and one is managing a food company. And I took them. They came with me from school. They were with me for 5 to 7 years, and they moved on. But I think that's great because we were just giving them the life skills to move on to other things.
No, that is great. Nice to be able to support people through that journey. And I think quite a lot of what you've said is based around community, be it community within the practice, be it community within the wider town, village, etc. But also you're involved in the dental community at a wider level in your role as a CQC specialist advisor. So I was just wondering if you could talk us through a little bit about what that involves for people that maybe don't know, but also why you decided to take some time out of practice to pursue something different.
I had a long-standing patient who was a CQC inspector, and she persuaded me to do it.
Okay.
But as a specialist advisor, my job is to provide clinical input and knowledge. The CQC does have a bad press, has had a bad press, but it's changed dramatically in the last few years, and the inspection is now more focused and relevant, and I think worthwhile, particularly now we have dental advisors on board. Our first inspection, I think, was 2015, maybe slightly earlier. And it was a fireman who did it, and he didn't have a clue. But I enjoy inspections immensely. I think I have visited over 250 practices in the last 5 years. Wow. By Christmas, it probably heading towards 300. And very few people want to see you, but it's the same as dentistry. You build a rapport. And if you build a rapport, you can get the most out of people. And from a personal point of view, it enables me to learn. I can see how others do things. And I've met some really inspiring and fascinating practice owners and teams and come back with stuff. And yeah, we'll have that. We'll use that. And it's a great learning experience.
So is that what attracted you? The fact that it was something a bit different to clinical dentistry and getting you a bit wider out in the dental community?
I think I always need a new challenge, whether it's at work or outside of work. And the practice was stable. The practice was full at capacity. And I just fancied doing something a bit different. And yeah, it enables you to get out. Yes, there's a lot of traveling involved, but I don't regret it. And I really enjoy doing it.
That sounds very interesting, sort of doing different things. And I think we often have pipe dreams to do these things, but you actually doing a realization and thinking, actually, there are things I can get out of this. I can bring things back to my own practice, may give our listeners something interesting to think about there. Clearly, your work with the CQC has brought a very different dynamic to your practice. And that's quite inspirational to hear, the fact that you go out, inspect these practices and bring things back to your own practice. So you're also quite involved with the local dental committee. What does that involve?
The local dental committee, for anyone who isn't aware, was set up to represent all NHS practitioners in an area. It's gradually been sidelined by NHS England until COVID hit, when they realised they needed us. I've been chair for... We used to do on a rotational basis, about 6 months each, because nobody wanted it. And then when COVID hit, I said I would become chair for as long as COVID lasted. And I tried to get out of it at the AGM last night, but I've been re-elected, so I'm still there.
Well, that's the trouble when you do a good job, isn't it?
But as I said, it's set up to represent all NHS practitioners in the area. But in Cumbria, we do things differently. And we are open to both NHS and private dentists. And this was highlighted during COVID, where fully private practitioners didn't get access to NHS emails, didn't get access to the NHS communications, the standard operating procedures. So I looked at our email list, and I think when I took over, we had 11 on the email list, and I think a couple of them may have been dead. We now have 168 dentists on my list, and it's all about communication. It's all about bringing people back together again. And we do need to stop this NHS private debate. Most practices are now mixed to some extent. And we've talked previously about dentistry being quite an insular profession. We don't get out. We don't meet each other very often. There was a practice just up the road from me. It took me 10 years before I actually met the dentist involved. He's only 200 metres up the road. So we hosted a dinner about 2 months ago for every dentist in Cumbria, just to get them post-COVID back together and talking to each other. And I think it's something we're going to do as an annual event, because that's our purpose, is to try and get people out and talking. And that will lead on to something later on when we talk about confidential. But part of it is, I've been involved in negotiations with the integrated care boards and discussions. And they don't get it. They don't see that in most areas, we are a dental desert in Cumbria. If you've left the NHS, you're not coming back. You know, we've reached that tipping point. We've reached that crisis point where anybody who's moved away from the NHS or reduced their commitment is not coming back to it. So we've got to find different ways of doing things. We've got to find different ways of working.
And I'm encouraged to hear that your private and NHS colleagues are working together on things like that. Why do you not think that everybody else is doing it that way?
I don't know.
It makes complete sense to do it like that when I hear about it. In fact, I'm faintly surprised and sad for those colleagues who are missing out.
So the LDCs are funded by contributions from performers from the NHS contract. And what we did is we asked all private practitioners to do a voluntary contribution. Yeah. And they've actually been quite generous. So they contribute the same as the NHS practitioners. So why can we not support them equally?
So if there's people listening that think from a networking community perspective, but also want to get more involved in their local LDC, how do people find out about these things? Someone might be thinking, saying, I've never even heard of this. How do I get involved? How would people find that out?
I think the BDA website has all the contact details for all the local LDCs, or just ask around. I mean, your local LDC chair should be readily available and should be publicised themselves. But if you're not sure, the BDA website is probably the best place to go.
Fair. And I'm sure they'd be more than happy to have people who want to get involved.
We always want fresh blood, definitely. Definitely.
And I think with fresh blood, with these sorts of groups that meet, they're much more than an educational unit, aren't they? They are a support. They're an information sharing safe space, if I can call it that.
I think I agree, because it is support. You know, people know that who we are, and my phone's always on. They can always phone or message at any time, and they'll get an answer.
And obviously, as a result of all of your hard work and hard investment in your own professional development, you've decided to share quite a lot and got involved with Confidential. Now, Confidential is obviously a fairly new initiative, if I can call it that, or a charity, whatever you'd like to describe it. But perhaps you can talk us through what that involves.
So Confidential is a charity, and it's very, very close to my heart. It's a listening service. It's available 24/7, and it's unique that it's manned by dental professionals. It began in 2011 when I had, unfortunately, the first anaphylaxis death from chlorhexidine in my surgery. The police got involved. It got very messy, and there wasn't any support around. But a dentist from Manchester, Jeremy Cooper, reached out and mooted the idea of a support network, a listening service. And it took 10 years to get to fruition. And the final prompt was a colleague ending their life in Manchester, and Confidential was born. There are three of us on call day and night. We do a 4-week. Calls can vary. They can be over an hour. The average is about 30 minutes. Where we're developing it, originally it was dentists only, but I've always been a believer in the whole team should be involved. And we expanded to hygienists and therapists earlier in the year, and watch this space, because hopefully within a very, very short period of time, we will be available to the entire dental team.
I think that's an amazing thing that you've done, and what a legacy to share with the listeners. And I can't imagine what your life was like 10 years ago, but to have the energy and the capacity to be a listener to those people who will continue to need your services, I think is an amazing thing. So bravo to you and all of your colleagues.
Sure. And you mentioned it being a crisis line, but what kind of things do people call about? Is it just people in crisis? Is there people that just need to talk, or what kind of things?
I think crisis line is probably the wrong word I should have used. Mm. It's more a listening service. So I think it's not just crisis. I would like someone, if they just had a bad day. If you've had a bad day at work and want someone to talk to, fine, ring up. It's not a problem at all. Because back when I qualified, if you'd had a bad day at work, you went to the pub or with a couple of mates, had a bit of a chat and went home, and it was all sorted. Mm. But there's less interaction. There's less social interaction. People look at Facebook, but you know, you might have 1,000 friends on Facebook, but who can you actually reach out to? Who can you actually talk to? Who's a true friend? So it is definitely about just the whole range. And pre-COVID, the first few years, the cause were, there was a bit of anxiety, and quite often anxiety that was disproportionate. An event that had happened a year or two previous caused that indemnity. I need to talk to you because I don't want to talk to my indemnity. And if anybody's listening to this, don't be scared about calling your indemnity. Your premiums won't go up. Just call them, because that's what you pay them. That's what they're for. And then when COVID hit, it kind of really took off. And the initial calls were about PPE. I can't get any. My boss is rationing it. What do I do? They were financial. How am I going to get paid? How's my practice going to survive? And they were kind of replaced. And if you look at some of the things that happened during COVID, as a profession, we didn't really cover ourselves in glory. There were some really bad stories of how colleagues interacted with each other. Some really good ones as well, but it wasn't perfect. Post-COVIDly, worryingly, it's colleagues who've qualified in the last 5 years. They are an increasing frequency of our callers. And you look back and you think about the reasons why, because they've had interruptions to their training. They've had interruptions to their FD year. They've got a completely different world to what they expected it to be. Patients are less tolerant than they were a few years ago. So that does worry me when people who've qualified in the last 5 years want to give up. And I think that's something as a profession that we really need to address.
A lot of the focus of this talk has been about community, be that wider community, dental community. And you were just saying there about people not having those social networks, not literal on the internet as in real life, to get that support. So what can we do as a profession, as professionals, to help support each other, to try and stop people from getting to that point of crisis or to that point where they've got anxiety, they're really concerned? Is there anything that we should be doing more of, do you think?
Looking at when we've done caller analysis, I mean, a lot of calls are from females, but that is not a reflection on female professionals because it's more a negative reflection on men. Men of my demographic, older males, we're alpha males, we're ahead of our practice, we're ahead of our family, and we don't talk to anybody. And we are the biggest risk. If you look at the colleagues who've ended their lives, I'm aware of 5 or 6 in the last, well, since 2020. And they've all been, that I'm aware of, older males, because we don't talk. And I think that's part of the reason we in Cumbria have started to look at doing these social networks, started to look at the community dinners, because it gets people out and meeting each other.
I mean, I'm listening to all of this and I absolutely hear what you're saying. And I think it's eye-opening to hear about these stories. But I'm also thinking about perhaps there may be people listening to this podcast who think, do you know, I wonder whether I might be able to volunteer and help for something like this, because I feel as though I've got a bit of life experience. I've been through certain things in my dental career. Is that something that you are actively trying to find more volunteers, or does it not work like that?
Funny you should say that. At the moment, we are actively recruiting as we speak. We have adverts on all the dental social media, which I've placed, and we are looking for new volunteers to be fully trained. We've got a training day in Manchester in the new year, and if anybody wants to apply, then please, yes, get in touch, because we are looking for new call handlers at the moment.
We're certainly going to be saying that, obviously, on the podcast, but unfortunately, this episode might not go out for a little while. But I'm sure you're always looking for new recruits.
Yeah, we are. I mean, it is a fine line, because I did a bit of analysis work based on call volumes, and you want call handlers to be busy, but not too busy, because if they're not busy enough, then they get bored. So it is a fine line. And we reckon the average to be on call is about 1 week in 4. 1 week in 5 is about the sort of right frequency.
And how many calls might you get in that time?
It varies. I've had 3 a day. I've had 3 in a week. It does vary. I think if you looked at the average, we'd be looking at 5 a week at the moment.
You've clearly got a great passion for this profession, and it is infectious to hear all of the projects that you either have got yourself involved in or historically got yourself involved in. But what sort of things do you see going on in the future of John Lewis?
Well, as I said earlier, I'm starting to revisit the entire practice and redo a root and branch review of everything I do. Rural recruitment is my other bit, trying to get more dentists and therapists to come to Cumbria, and I've done quite a bit of work on that. I do a bit of mentoring support. People I've met, people who just call me, so I'm quite involved in that. I don't have any plans to retire. I quite enjoy what I'm doing, and I want to do more rowing. I don't do enough rowing at the moment. I do it most days, but I think I'd like to do more.
So you just mentioned there about rural recruitment. Can you expand on that? What kind of thing? Because it's something that keeps coming up and something we keep talking about, and no one seems to necessarily know the answer. So I'm just intrigued as to what kind of work you've been involved in that arena.
It started about, I can't remember the exact date, about 2 years ago, 3 years ago. I wrote an article for the BDJ in practice on rural recruitment. And I put a few things on dental forums, and I had over 500 responses. Emails, calls, just per private messages. And it made me really think, because we've got our manpower projection is totally and utterly wrong. When I qualified, we had 55% white male dentists. We had two graduates in my year from an ethnic minority. That's gone through a complete role reversal, a complete cycle. There's more females in dentistry. There are more people from an ethnic minority in dentistry. And one of the quotes that I had from a dentist I know really well said, "We perceive Cumbria to be rural and remote and white." I said, "Yeah, it's a fair point, but if you look at and then there's a dentist in Whitehaven who on the West Coast who's an Afghan refugee, and he said Cumbria's been the most welcoming place he's ever been to in all his time in England. So I think it's about getting the message out. It's about looking at the ethnic mix and looking at the planning of workforce planning. And it's about trying to make, if you're expecting, I've got a dentist with me who is from Pakistan. And it's about putting a package together. It's not just about offering a job and saying, come and join me. You've got to, we went through schooling, housing, how to set up a bank account. We did the whole lot. We put a complete package together. Because if I moved to an overseas country, I wouldn't have a clue what I was doing. Mm. So put yourself in someone else's shoes, and you've got to not just offer a job, you've got to offer a complete and utter package. And it's not just for them, it's for their partner as well.
Yeah, and I think if you put that investment in, I think you get twice as much back, in my experience of doing things like that. That if people feel really valued, then you will get a lot from them.
I think I totally agree. You know, and when someone's come with a family and they put down roots and the kids are in local schools, you know they're going to stay. You know they're not going to leave.
Yeah. Well, who would leave your wonderful practice? It sounds like an amazing practice. And obviously, you know, there's so many lovely things around Cumbria to enjoy when you're not at work. So, and you're living proof of that, of course. Anyway, thank you so much, John, for coming on this podcast today. It's been a real joy to listen to your stories and be inspired by your career journey.
Yeah, thank you, John. There's lots of interesting things that we talked about, and hopefully a lot of that will resonate with the listeners, and they'll go away with some things to think about for sure.
That's brilliant. Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
If you've been inspired by that episode, did you know that the Eastman Dental Hospital Education Centre provide training for the whole dental team? Follow us on social media or search for the Eastman Dental Hospital Education Centre to find out more.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode. We would love to hear your suggestions for future guests. Remember to follow us on social media using hashtag the Eastman Dental Podcast. And if you like what you hear, please like, share, subscribe, and listen out for future episodes.